My name is Verlon Brown, and the title of this session is Yearning and Burning. Why I chose this title is that when I knew I was going to do this, I was sitting at home and listening to some music, and just so happens I was listening to James Taylor, and he's got this blues tune called Steamroller, and it sort of reminded me of Advent. Advent is a time of waiting for the coming of Christ. In fact, Advent means come Lord Jesus. And so if you know what that song's about, the feeling of it is sort of a yearning. Now it's kind of a yearning for a different reason than Advent, but nonetheless, it's yearning. And part of the song, he goes on, and he's a yearning. How does it go, Tom?
Yearning, churning, burning.
So yeah, something like that. But and he talks about being a yearning and a burning, and he talks about being in sort of a what he calls a funk. And if you know to be in sort of a blue funk, it's sort of a period. It's sort of a moodiness, and that's kind of what Advent is, sort of a moodiness. Who here ever celebrated Advent in their homes? Wow, that's pretty advanced crowd here. My wife and I were talking about Advent, and we were saying in our homes, Advent was sort of like a countdown for Christmas. You know, you light those candles, and it's like 5, 4, 3, 2, you know.
It's sort of like, I can't believe how fast this is.
Yeah, and that's kind of what Advent was in my home, and not till I became a pastor or started studying for the ministry did it really sink into me, or did I ever really learn what Advent was about. To pick up on our theme, to sort of pick up on what we talked of, what the Vespers was about tonight, I'll do a little exercise here for you. It's nothing heavy, but it's what is that? It's a seven. But what I can do with that seven. So I mean, that's what you can do with a seven. Cute, huh? You can do that with just about any other number. Give me a number, a difficult one, between 1 and 10.
8.
Oh,
okay.
Three.
What?
5.
Okay. I hear 3, I hear 8, and I hear 5. Well, 5 is almost just like 7. So.
Oh, I can't see.
That's pretty easy. eight would kind of be the same way, but that would be the same. Okay. All I got when I was growing up is my mother, you know, put that stuff down and come and eat dinner, you know, that kind of thing. But what that is supposed to sort of get across, for me anyway, is that Advent is not just what you do with a particular season is not limited to tradition. And that tradition is supposed to pick up on old stuff and go to new stuff. And there's sort of like a movement, or there is a movement for me in tradition. And it should always be moving. The moment that it is stuck in one particular spot, then it no longer becomes effective. The purpose of tradition is to connect us with where we are, and then to move us on. And the purpose behind that is that you begin to look at things in a different way. You know, a seven is a seven, but it can be a face. You know, or three is a three, but you can do that with anything. It's not just what it's supposed to be. You know, like the old story of I think it was Michelangelo, and he was walking down the street with a big, you know, marble block, and someone says, "Where are you going with that block?" And he says, "That's no block, that's David," or something like that. You know, that sort of thing. Advent doesn't just sit there. Advent picks up on the past, connects us with the future. Has anybody, I assume someone in here is familiar, most people are in here, would be familiar with Joseph Campbell. One of the things that Joseph Campbell talks about is ritual. And he says the purpose of ritual is to link us with humanity, to link us with humanity and with God. And but it's also another purpose is to pitch us out into the world. And then yet a third purpose is to keep us on track where we're out into the world. And this is what hopefully the seasons of the church year does for us. It connects us with God and humanity, but it also pitches us out there into the world to do the work of the Lord. And then it keeps us on track. The church year keeps us on track, keeps us coming back to the saving grace of Jesus Christ and how we celebrate that in the course of a year. The church calendar is starts with what's called the triduum, and there are like it used to be just three parts to it. There used to be Epiphany, and then there was Lent, and then there was Christmas, and all of these imply movement. Moving closer and closer to the Christ. And then later on it was added Advent. So the four main parts of the year for us now is Epiphany, not in this order, but Epiphany, Lent, Christmas, and Advent. And everything moves us from the birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. There's that continual movement towards Jesus Christ. Advent, of course, means, like I said, Come Lord Jesus, or Maranatha, as it's called. And the purpose of Advent, the season of Advent, is a season of waiting. One of the things we talk about here at Holden is, for those of us on program staff, we're always, you know, whenever there's a retreat, you know, we get together and we start talking about what can we do, let's do this, let's do that, let's do the other kind of thing. And it occurred to me that one of the things we can do at Holden, that we can give people at Holden that they can't get anywhere else. You could get the food somewhere else. You know, you'd have to pay for for it, but you know, a pretty price for healthy food now. And then, mountains and snow and that sort of thing. There are other places you can get that. But one of the things we can continually give here at Holden is time. And that's sort of what Advent is about. The waiting, the time, the slowing things down to focus us in and prepare us for the coming of the Christ child. And involved in this is waiting and also in yearning. There's a certain amount of yearning for the Christ child to come. And you're yearning for several things. You're yearning for on several different levels. You're yearning for Christ to come into our hearts, yearning for Christ to come into our lives and into our community. The thing about Christ coming in, the sort of scary part is that one of the things you're yearning for is for Christ to come into our community, but also to come to for the finalization of history, for the completion of history as we know it. And that's kind of hard to think about and for that, to be yearning for that, to be yearning for an end, especially if you're having a good time, you know. But you know, a lot of people aren't having a good time, but the purpose is not whether you're having a good time or not. It's this is the promise. This is what God has promised us. The coming back at the end of time to gather us into God's kingdom. There's also a sense of urgency about it. A sense of now. Is you know, wondering if this is the right time or is it the right time. I gave a sermon last Sunday and I talked about my first kiss in the basement of the church that I grew up in. And this girl, she kissed me, and I had no idea why. You know, I mean, I didn't ask for it. I didn't, you know, do anything. I was just kind of there. But then after she kissed me, then I was ready. I said, you know, this is a good thing. So I tried again, but I tried, but she was no longer interested. You know, she simply was not interested anymore. Nothing I could do at that age could get her interested in kissing me again. And I talked about how I spent a lot of my time. You know, no one explains timing to you. You know, your parents don't sit down and talk about timing, about, you know, whether it's a joke or life or whatever. It's just some vague concept out there, timing, you know. So you spend a lot of your time going, now, you know, and it's kind of like it connects with this urgency, this now kind of thing. And then also involved in Lent, in Advent, well, they rhyme. In Advent is a sense of silence, the silence, the waiting for Christ, the quietness. I wrote my, I have a buddy of mine in Utah, and I wrote him just yesterday and told him he could walk outside of town here, and it was just as quiet as it was anywhere in the world, you know. And I said it was just amazing how quiet it is here. And growing up in the city, I lived in Washington, D.C. for 6 years before I came here. It was never quiet in Washington, D.C. And that quietness, that stillness, implies a sense of waiting, a sense of contemplation, that sort of thing in people's lives. And then there's also a longing, to long for something. A longing is something you feel, you know, really sort of deep down inside, a longing for personal stuff or, you know, worldwide kinds of things. What are some things that people long for? There's a sort of a touchy-feely game you play that you ask people if they were if before they died, if it was something they could have before they died, what could it be? Whether it's on a personal level or a worldwide level, that's kind of how you get at what people are yearning for. What kind of things are people yearning for? Can you just kind of yell some stuff out?
Balance.
Peace.
Some kind of an accomplishment.
Accomplishment, yeah.
Like climbing the mountain or something.
Yeah, yeah. There's all kinds of statistics out there. You know, you read any news magazines and you get statistics. My head is full of statistics, and I'm not even sure how true they are anymore, how long ago I read them. But like, every 6 minutes a woman is raped. Every 13 seconds a woman is battered. 370,000 pregnant women are regular users of drugs. 40,000 people die a day of hunger. You know, this is the stuff that we yearn to deal with, that we yearn for Christ to come into our lives and put an end to make us whole, to make it a whole creation. It's also fractured, you know. I mean, used to be there was only one 12-step program, you know. Now there are about, as you know, 20, 30, as many as you can name almost. I mean, it's just an example of the brokenness that permeates our existence. And this is what we're yearning for Christ to come into our lives, for God to come in and to complete history, to make us whole, to make us whole people of God. Commercialization, you know, I mean, if the media could do something with this kind of stuff, I think it would, but I'm not sure how popular it is to yearn for something. I mean, you can't yearn in 60 minutes. I mean, 60 seconds, which is about as long as a commercial. You know, you yearn for 30 seconds, and then the next 30 seconds, you got it there. You know, and you talk about how beautiful it is, and that kind of thing. You know, so it's not a thing that can be. Advent is not a thing that can readily be. Can be commercialized because it kind of smacks at all the things that Americans are famous for not being interested in, waiting, the yearning for stuff, silence, longing for things, waiting for Christ to come. These are not, you know, typical American things that you know that work well for us, or the things we're noted for, the things people say this is what you should be to be a good American, sort of. There are various symbols of of Advent also. There are the symbol of the lamb and the lion laying down together, that symbol of peace. And I think of all these pictures you've seen of Christ or of Jesus in places, of Jesus there on the ground with a lamb and a lion, and that kind of thing. It reminds me, once I was in the South, and I was at McDonald's, and I saw this picture of the lamb and the lion, but instead of Jesus, it was like Ronald McDonald there. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird, but you know, I didn't think anything else about it. And then I was at another McDonald's, and I saw another picture with, you've seen the ones of Jesus walking down the road holding a kid's hand, and then there's a lamb on the other side. Well, it was Ronald McDonald walking. I said, ooh, this is kind of bizarre. But, I don't know what that had to do with this, sort of, but it just kind of struck me as sort of weird, and I kind of blame it on the South, but that's not fair. But and I know it's before Elvis died, because now I think Elvis would be there instead of that's neither here nor there. But anyway, so that's another symbol that's of Advent, and these are symbols that that you don't see often. Most people use the Advent wreath and that's sort of about it. But there's a number of symbols that go along with Advent, and for me these symbols, you know, like I said, they're supposed to imply some sort of movement or prompt us for some sort of movement to move with history, as opposed to just sitting there and being just kind of let it, you know, see it and say that's Advent and, you know, and that's that. I worked with homeless people in 6 years in Washington, D.C., and there are just endless ways that people could work out Advent with working with homeless people. Things you can do, intentional things that you can do. Most people just think of giving food or giving clothes, and I a lot of people's idea of giving clothes is going through the closet at springtime and picking up stuff that they don't want and taking it down to homeless people, or right around the end of the year for tax purposes, giving stuff to homeless people. There are other things you can do. Some families talk about having a kitty, and they put aside money every year for something in the family. But another thing you could do is put aside money every year and say, $50, go out and buy $50 worth of men's underwear and take it down to your, I don't want to say your local shelter, but it's getting to that point, you know. Take it down to a shelter and give it to people. Or we talked today about doing something more than just food and clothes, going someplace, helping people fill out forms for income tax or SSI checks or PA checks or something that implies more than just going dumping stuff off. Advent is a time of waiting, but it's also we should take that tradition and move it into our modern times. Another symbol of Advent is the crocus flower, or the flower, the first flower of Easter, or it's a desert flower, and it implies a new thing taking place in our lives. This this new thing that that God has brought to us. And this I tried to find pictures of it. I remember seeing it before. I tried to find another one to kind of prompt my memory, but I'm not a big flower person. But it's the first flower of the spring, and it's also a desert flower, but I can't really describe what it looks like. But that's one of the symbols of Advent as well. And also the Jesse stump, this this stump of a tree, this dead tree that symbolizes the death in humanity, the death of our spirits and our psyche, and then out of this stump comes a shoot, a green shoot that implies life, that God can work through this hunk of dead stump and bring about life. That's another symbol, and of course, the Advent wreath. And then one of the things about the Advent wreath that I certainly didn't know of as a child was that it implies each week where it's getting lighter and lighter, moving from the darkness to the lightness of Christ. And then after the Advent wreath comes the open door that you see a lot of for Advent calendars, an open door, which is a wonderful symbol to move out of one tradition into another tradition. All the images that come to mind of an open door, what that means, what that implies, the opportunity for us as Christians involved in an open door. And then there's the Jesse tree, which is kind of a new symbol, but it's a tree with 28 branches, which is for the 28 Sundays in the church year, and also for the prophets. Symbol. And then there's a road, the journey. Everybody is on this journey, the journey to Bethlehem, which begins not just with the Mary and Joseph story, but begins from the Adam and Eve and moves on to Christ, to the even beyond Bethlehem, if we think in terms of the coming of Christ. And then there's the colors of Advent, which is purple, of course, but now it's blue. So some people mix the two. I mean, as we do here, it makes for a nice mixture. I'm not sure when it changed or why it changed. I know growing up it was purple for royalty, the royalty of Christ, and now I know it's blue that implies hope, and it's also the color for Mary, the mother of Christ. But I'm not sure. Maybe somebody here who knows more about that sort of thing could tell me when it changed and why it changed. Do you know, Scott?
No, except that I think it was an attempt to distinguish it from Lent.
Oh.
Okay. It's been in the last 10 years.
Say that again?
I think it's been in the last 10 years,
yeah.
Too.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
I don't mean to steal your thunder, but we have an Advent banner, and I'm not sure whether this is a traditional symbol or whether we just came up with this in our church, but we have a large banner with a blue background, and it has the ark and a rainbow, and it's for the promise of the Savior.
I don't know. I didn't come across that, but
it may be just something that we just applicable. You know, made up ourselves. But I know that someone had this idea, and then we took it to one of our people in the church that loves to design, and we love it. We can hardly wait till we can get it up every year.
Well, there's certainly no harm in finding another. I mean, the promise is what everybody's waiting for in Advent, and just it fits perfectly. Another symbol is the sun, the sun of righteousness, oftentimes depicted as a sun with wings on it, rising out of Malachi. You know, I don't know if that touches into the rainbow thing or not. You know, but yeah.
Yeah. We also had a banner one year with a star. That's the first Sunday in Advent was a small star, and each Sunday the star was replaced with a larger one until Christmas.
Oh, yeah, that's great. You are still in the thunder. That's okay. That's I like both those ideas. Those are ideas that I've never heard of or seen. Does anyone else have any? Any symbols that they've used that they remember at their church different than any of the ones that I mentioned? Well, it's good. It fits right in here. Yeah, there is a great emphasis on yearning for justice. All the Old Testament, many of the Old Testament books talk about justice, and there is a yearning for justice, and that Jesus brings along righteousness, and so it all connects to this feeling of wholeness.
I was thinking not only of visual symbols, but of musical symbols, and some of my favorite church music are Advent songs. And the one I remember as a child was O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, yeah. And kind of a minor key, and that certainly is evocative of yearning. And I think I got pretty sentimental about Advent along the line, and until one Advent here, when Peter Hendrickson was our musician and also somewhat of a theologian and got us singing Wake Awake, and he gave the title in German, which is Wach auf, watch out. Wake and you up. Can't help but kind of sit up. It goes right at my spine when I hear those words, and it kind of broke through my sentimentality about Advent and said, hey, you know, we're not sure what we're waiting for, and it may be a little bit scary, which you were suggesting earlier, but that always stuck with me since then.
Yeah. Used to be the first Sunday in Advent was the gospel lesson about the 10 maidens, which was last week. Mm-hmm. And but used to be the first Sunday in Advent where you hear about the 10 maidens and the five foolish maidens and the five wise maidens and not having enough oil and waiting for the bridegroom, and you don't know the time or the hour, and that urgency, that sense of urgency to wait and be watchful, sort of thing. I don't know why they changed that either. Maybe that went with the purple. I don't know. There are some things that even I don't know. But sure.
I was thinking of the...
You want to see him?
No. You've been accused of having a soft voice. Of the four Advent collects in the LBW, which I always... The first lines always made me shiver. It was the stir of your power, O Lord. And that sense of, what did you say, pitching us out, mm-hmm. was really in that. I read them again this year and realized they're really very... male and stern in a lot of ways, but still, when I hear that stir up your power, I just get shivery. And good Advent symbol for me.
Yeah, there is a it does pitch us out into the world. We have to get out there with these symbols and with these. Most times when we think of Christmas, we all think of sitting around home and just a family sort of thing. But to me, it can still be a family sort of thing, but a family sort of thing that reaches out to the larger community. There was a woman here named Jane Blewett, and she talked about she was what's known as an eco-feminist, and she talked about radical theology, and she says radical theology is not what people think, stirring up trouble. All radical theology is finding an alternative, saying that doesn't work for me, this does. And one of the themes you'll hear throughout your time here is an alternative approach to Christmas, some alternative that many people are yearning for. Sitting around the dining hall talking to people since these past few weeks, and many of us were saying what a relief it is not to be out there now with all the commercials and all the pitch for Christmas and that sort of thing. And for us, this is an alternative way. And so to go out there and live out Advent doesn't mean you go and tear down something. It just means you find another way, a way that's more meaningful for you. And a lot of times that's subversive enough. What are we waiting for? What are we waiting for? There are several names used for Jesus during this season. King Solomon talked about wisdom. That was a name used for Jesus, and he talks about it in a real intimate way about if he could only take wisdom home and take wisdom to his chamber and sleep next to wisdom, which in some ways may connect to the yearning and burning song. But I'm sure it's on a different level. Christ speaks to people in different ways. And, his way was that knowledge that the Hebrew word, that yada, to know God, was a real sexual thing. And this wisdom for Solomon is a real intimate sexual thing to really get to know wisdom. Emmanuel is another name for Jesus. Adonai, which means the lawgiver, is what people were yearning for. Odei Spring, the key and the key of David, that Christ opens up, is connected with the whole reign of David and that whole sort of thing. This is all the different ways that people have connected with Christ, with this promise of God coming into our lives, making us whole, fulfilling the promise. The four Sundays of Advent, the first two are always apocalyptic, about the coming of Christ. The third one usually deals with John the Baptist, and the fourth one deals with Mary and the mother of Jesus, who became the servant of Jesus and his first disciple. But that's the way the the month, the 5 weeks of waiting plays it to itself out in Scripture. But the purpose of it is a movement towards Christ, but it implies movement nonetheless in the, towards this yearning. That's sort of all I have to say about it. I don't know.
Do you have some time for us to talk about it then?
Sure.
Well, seems to me that at the first coming of Christ, that it was really a pretty big surprise. I think the people that to whom he came, the people that were waiting, were basically the poor people, the people who had been suffering under injustice. And they had almost given up hope of anything coming. It had been a long time since the last prophets had said anything and had stirred anything up. There was a kind of a gap, a period of time where, I don't know whether how accurate I am in this, I just have this impression that they were kind of giving up hope. And you know, they weren't waiting expectantly, and I mean, of course they had a yearning, but I mean, it isn't like they really thought something was going to happen. And so when Christ did come, it was a real big surprise. And when he came and he favored the poor and the ones that had been suffering injustice and were oppressed. And in fact, he was a big disappointment and a threat to the most of the priests and the establishment. In fact, Herod and the army went out and killed a bunch of boys because of him, baby boys, because when he came.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely
okay.
True.
Well, let me go the other half of this then. Where are we in this? I think most of us have absolutely no idea of what it's like to suffer injustice. We only hear about it, but we don't actually experience it. We don't come from the background of homelessness. We just hear about it. And we're sort of like the rich people that try to help out those who are homeless. And we're the ones who are, I'm going to get on dangerous ground here, but you know, we aren't really the ones who suffer the abuse and the abandonment and all the things. We hear a lot about it. And so maybe we're in solidarity with them, or we want to sympathize with them or something. And I mean, maybe we need to get away from the idea that we're sort of yearning for the same kind of a coming as the first one. We want a big surprise like when he came. Because we have problems in this world that are horrendous, and we don't know how to solve these problems. Homelessness is going to double, and I'm in a community where there's a lot of teachers, and I hear all the stuff from teachers. It's going to become absolutely hopeless to run society after a while. It's getting so bad. I said enough. I mean, maybe you don't see what I'm going with that, but I'm wondering whether we're a lot like the people were when Christ came the first time.
Yeah.
Maybe we're ready for him to come the second time in an entirely different way.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, and I think the surprise for the people was not only that Jesus came, but how Jesus came, and this scandal of an unwed mother and that whole thing, born in a manger. Christ didn't come as this king who took over, that kind of thing. You're absolutely right, you know, that is a big surprise.
And he's full of good.
Yeah. So, yeah. And you touch on Advent, this yearning, but I think Libby said it. We're not sure what we're yearning for. You know, we yearn for this wholeness, this completion of history, but we're just not sure what it is. So it's kind of a scary thing. You know, it's both. Anyone else?
Well, it could be argued that the theology is actually not for us. You know, that some of our, and I think that's kind of what you're saying, that maybe that's why we struggle so much with this theology. It's not that we don't understand it, but we're not suffering. I mean, and, you know, maybe that's where Advent has to get back to. Maybe he has to get back to him. And I don't mean like a Lent type, throw ashes on your body and walk around, you know, burlap on yourself. I'm thinking that, you know, maybe we need to start addressing what are the problems and, you know, what is going on in this world versus you know, and maybe get ready for the second coming versus go through another season, you know, once again decide to spend, you know, how much you're going to spend on your friends, how much your friends going to spend on you, setting limits for gifts and all sorts of things. That's a struggle that I go through. And I'm not sure that this theology is for me.
Well, that's the struggle of Advent, and that's the struggle many of us deal with, and I think Advent calls us to task on that. You know, Advent, I mean, it's time for new traditions, and Advent is telling us to move. I mean, to look at this world, look what we're yearning for, and then look how we're dealing with it. You know, people are yearning for peace and an end to injustice or whatever, and we're giving out electric razors for Christmas. I mean, you know, there's no connection there.
Merla, have you thought much about why Christmas is so popular? Why?
It's not on my notes.
In Sweden, Christmas is the biggest church festival of the year. Not Easter. It's Christmas. And we make it up that way. And I've never really thought until recently that Advent is like Lent. That it's a time of preparation. And I wonder if that we play a baby Jesus so much because that's a Jesus we can kind of control. And it's not a Jesus that's separating sheep and goats.
And it's sentimental.
Yeah, and if you're a capitalist, you can make money off of a baby. You know, you can't make much money off of Lent. You know, there's nothing to be had at Lent, you know. So in a capitalist society, I think, you know, you hold up where you can make the bucks.
The point of that chapter is that the people who have the power and are in charge have not been doing what God wanted. And I mean, the gist of that chapter is that God is fed up with this, and so he's going to take away that power and control, and he's going to come and give a new shepherd, and the new shepherd is going to do the job right. And I feel like we're the ones that are being criticized in that. We're the ones that are being not being faithful shepherds and taking care of everything, because we end up in the situation where we're warm and we're comfortable and we're well fed. We don't really know what, we haven't experienced homelessness. We haven't experienced not having a job and a place to go. Some of us have, of course, but I mean, basically, we're the real well-off people of the world.
Have you met Al Pitcher?
Wow.
Al Pitcher will be addressing just that this weekend. The name escapes me. What is
scholar in residence?
He's our scholar in residence, and he deals with the whole global economy and where it's heading because of the Western world. And I think you two will connect very well.
I was thinking too that this thing with the purple, and it was Lent, the Lent color. And it seems to me when I was a child that the whole focus of Advent was repentance. And there was a real strong connection to self-denial. And we had Wednesday services. And we had, I mean, there was no Christmas. Of course, I, long ago and far away where I grew up, nobody did Christmas till like the 24th. And that's when you started. So we didn't have this bombardment of... By the time Christmas comes, sometimes you're glad it's over because it's been going on for 2 months, you know? And I guess I resent the world stealing my festival, which I could have if up until the 23rd or 24th, I could focus on a whole different mindset.
Well, see, that's what Advent is saying. Advent is saying you can take it back.
Well,
you don't have to go to the mall.
That's the need I'm feeling.
Some people... Say, I remember talking to a group of people, and they were saying one thing they do for Advent is they don't go to the mall the whole season of Advent. They refuse to go to a mall.
They get their shopping done before Thanksgiving.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you can take Advent.
It's not self-denial at all.
No, it isn't. It's just a present you give yourself.
Well, yeah, they do it early, but at the same time, it's in preparation for Christmas. Mm-hmm. I mean, that time they're spending fighting people off in the mall, chasing down the red light, you know.
blue light.
Chasing down the blue light, you know.
And you're the church of the colors,
yeah.
Red light is something else. It has to do with your title, I think.
But ritual is supposed to keep us on track. It's supposed to link us, pitch us out, but keep us on track. And you have to say no to the commercial stuff and do what you need to do to keep yourself on track.
I think that's important. I think that we have to take control of our own lives. And it's very difficult to do that. It's difficult to resist the temptation to fall into all the traps that are created for us, that we create for ourselves. But we have to speak to ourselves, and if we don't like all of this stuff, then we have to say, well, what am I going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And I can't save the world, but I can make my life a little bit better. And maybe I can influence one other person if I'm lucky.
I think the biblical and prophetic corrective to this commercialization of Christmas, which is really a paganization of it,
yeah,
is that John the Baptist figure. Can you imagine John the Baptist in a mall?
Oh, he'd be arrested so fast.
Yeah, they'd probably cut his head off.
He'd come right down and get
him. He was the one who was preparing the way.
Yeah.
We did in my family, a really neat tradition that I'd love to share because I'm missing it so much now. It's been hard since we've all left home, but at the beginning of Advent, we'd all partake in making the wreath, and there were four kids, so it worked out well, lighting the candles, and we all each lit one each week. But the first Sunday of Advent, we'd put all our names in the hat, and we'd draw a name, and the object was to give. My mom always read something from the Bible about giving, and we just talked about the meaning of giving and preparation for what Christmas is supposed to be. And we had to give to the person we picked in the hat kindness. We had to be extra special for that person throughout the month of Advent. And my dad always loved it because the object was that you didn't let that person know who you got, so everyone was nice to everyone in the house, which is nice. And it got kind of silly. Dad, is there anything I can do for you? But on Christmas Eve, we'd all gather around, and Christmas Eve is always the best. We'd all gather around, and we'd guess who we all got, and we'd share the nice things that they did for us. And then we made something for that person. We couldn't buy anything for them, but we had to prepare throughout the month a special gift for that person.
And one of the sessions that's going to take place this weekend is on alternative gift giving. Is that right, Jan?
It's not just gift giving. Christmas was the working title.
Oh, okay.
We're calling it You Are What You Celebrate.
Okay.
But the idea is to explore what celebration is and alternatives, you know, based on the deeper meaning of celebration. So we're hoping to discuss.
So that's a plug for that, for people who are looking for alternatives. Yeah, Jim?
This builds on that, and something, Eric, you mentioned earlier about we're comfortable. Your idea is we're comfortable with the baby Jesus because it's one we can control, manipulate. I might have learned this from you, I don't remember, but that in oppressed countries, the image of Christ, which is most celebrated and most held up as being the most worthy Christ, is the one that's seen on Good Friday. That even more than the risen Christ, they relate to the ripped and bleeding and just bedraggled wreck.
And crucifix with the Christ on.
Yeah, we live in such a one-parade world, and I'm trying to tie this to what you were saying earlier about
we look forward so to Christmas because it's our holiday, you know, it's the one that we can control, and it just reminds us of where we are in the world and how much we've got, and, you know, gosh, isn't it nice to celebrate that yet again? And at the same time, that's a very powerful and damning sign on our society that says, here's the image of Christ we're most comfortable with. It's the one that we see as least powerful, at least in human form. Mm-hmm. And where there's an odd, real tragic kind of power to this ripped and bleeding Good Friday figure. That's, I think, an entirely different, much less controllable, and very spooky power that we aren't quite sure what's going to happen if that gets unleashed. And the oppressed people would love to have it. Yeah.
We really couldn't handle a bedraggled-looking Jesus. We'd have to get him on a talk show and give him a makeover, you know, because this bleeding, bedraggled guy just doesn't fit to our image at all.
But what I want to know is that these guys were talking about the image of God as a baby being something controllable, full, as heavy as babies yet.
Yeah, but you know,
that's the baby Jesus.
Like
baby Jesus is always
smiling.
Yeah, but you know when you're
Jesus is also 12 years old in the crib.
Yeah, you know when you're in kindergarten and you ask your Sunday school teacher, did the baby Jesus potty on himself and all that kind of stuff? You know, that's not the baby Jesus that we ever see.
Can
you know,
imagine.
Every baby yeah. Jesus we see is clean and. And smiling, or you know, yeah, he's not crying.
We imagine it perfectly.
Yeah, controlled.
It's interesting what Jim was saying about the baby Jesus being controllable. That the in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance, the baby Jesus, the infant Jesus, and the manger scenes took on quite a different sort of aspect than we have now, and the baby Jesus. Was a warrior Jesus coming to bring justice and the dichotomy, the paradox of this incredible power and this helpless form was the thing that they were most interested in. And there are many parallels in that age to the age that I believe we're coming into. We haven't internalized it yet, but the conversation tonight indicates that we're all beginning to internalize it. This incredible fear, sense of foreboding that I think we have, that we're about to discover some of the aspects of the baby Jesus and some of the aspects of God that we have kind of been able to keep out of our comfortable mainstream churches. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to meet those images of God pretty powerfully. And
it's affecting us directly now.
Yeah.
It's called gasoline. You know, you can't just hop in your car and drive to buy a Christmas present going, you know, the gas prices are going. Why is that affecting us?
The trouble is we still do it anyway.
The trouble is that we still can
do it anyway.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about it a heck of a lot more than I used to. Because of what's happening inside. It's like...
Who has a hand?
I have a couple of questions. I grew up partially in the camp that you're going to talk about the crucifixes with the bloodied and the crucified Lord on there. And I was wondering, when did his form come off the crosses? I've noticed in the Protestant churches that most don't have his form. It's just this nice wooden cross that's very clean, very easy to look at, very easy to carry around. It doesn't have his form on there at sign. And when did that change?
I don't know.
It never did for everybody, but she's right. It did in lots of churches. It truly did. And in fact, our pastor at home talks about a struggle in a congregation where there were two factions. And fortunately, I can't tell you who it is. But the one faction would come in and take down the one cross and put a different one up. And this would go on over a period of years. They literally were fighting over the form of the cross in the church. One wanting it to be the clean antiseptic, and the other one wanting it to be the instrument of torture that it really is.
The instrument of torture is not what comes to mind when I think of a cross in the church.
We think of the empty cross, Christ is often there.
It is moved to just a symbol.
Well, we have an ascended Christ, a triumphant Christ cross with a Holy Spirit carving in the top part. It's really an incredible cross, but it doesn't really show the suffering.
Well, oh, yes, God.
Yeah, I just, if I remember my history correctly, I'm not sure about this, but it seems to me that Advent was originally associated with a time of preparation for baptism. And then it was in later years that it got associated with Christmas. And the baptism of Jesus was, at least in the Eastern Church, celebrated in January, I think. I think we still have those texts early on. And in the Eastern Church, to this day, Christmas is, I think, sometime in January. And it's a rather minor festival compared to the, you know, the celebration in the West. And it would be interesting to recover some of the significance of Advent, perhaps, as a time of preparation for baptism, or for those of us who are baptized, a remembering of what our baptismal covenant is all about. And that's a thought that occurs to me sitting here. The other thing that folks mentioned, which I think is fascinating, I don't know when this happened, but it was sometime obviously after the Reformation when the Protestant cross clearly became the triumphal one of glory. And it's also interesting that in our churches it's not even rooted in the ground, it's usually hung up in the air somewhere. Yeah. So that not only do we lose the suffering aspect, but we lose the whole connection to the earth, with the cross. And so that's, you know, military chaplains solved that problem a long time ago. They have a cross with the crucifix on one side and the triumphal cross on the other. They just turn it around. Depending on
hey, what they're talking.
If you've ever been in a military chapel,
don't even some churches. There's, I think, Baptists and Methodists put the cross in the back of the church, and Lutherans put it in the front.
Well, a lot of those churches don't even have a cross. Yeah. There were some of them that were, you know, really came out of the left wing of the Reformation. Zwingli threw everything out of the church, you know, even the cross.
They have a little point on the top, a little spire.
Well, thank you all very much.
Just one little thing yet, because I'm sort of on a quest for something that I need to find. The connection with something that this fellow said about the ragged Christ. One of the things I want to try to find here this weekend is a tape that was done of a sermon preached by Walter Longgren at the time that both Elmer Witt and Susan Briel were here. And the reason I know about this is I heard a piece of this played in church last Sunday at our church. And the image of Christ defending the sinners of the world in the last judgment is the image of the Lamb being assaulted by all of the weapons of Satan. And this is in this speech by Walter Longgren. And he explains that this opened up the wounds from which a river of blood flowed out. And that's the blood that cleanses us from all of our sins. And I would love to get my hands on a copy of that tape this weekend. So if anybody here can help me find that, or know about it.
We already looked through all of Longgren's tapes.
It's hidden in the title because I don't know what the title of that tape is. But I'll try to find it this week.
Were you here? Were you?
I wasn't here, but somebody I know was here.
But you know the year.
I'm sorry, I don't know the exact year. I just know that Elmer Witt was here and Susan Briel was here. I think.
Okay. Maybe we all could take it. I think we have about 300 hours of Walter's
That's part of my problem.
We could at least take 10 hours or something.
Yeah, we'll find it.